Vice Chancellor, Deputy Dean of Arts, distinguished guests, particularly the Barry family, John Barry, Ada, and Susie, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great honour for me to be here tonight. It's very much a coming home to my old university where I worked many years ago. My job tonight is just to introduce the speaker, Peter Norden, but also I've been asked to say a few words about John Barry. Apparently the organisers of this event found it difficult to find anyone who's old enough to remember Barry personally. I qualified for that. I'm sure that I could talk for a long time about Barry, but I've been told I mustn't speak for more than 10 minutes, so I'll try and stick to that. I should put my watch down, shouldn't I? So John Barry was the second of my two major professional mentors who influenced my early life in criminal justice and criminology. The first mentor was Alec Watmore, who, when I first met him in 1953, had the title, would you believe, of Inspector General of Prisons, Penitentiaries and Hulks for the state of Victoria. As far as I know, we didn't actually have any hulks at that time, but we had a title which was given to Watmore. It was Watmore who guided me, a very young and inexperienced primary school teacher, through 11 years working as an education officer, either establishing or maintaining education and training programs in four different prisons. I learned later that Watmore was a very close friend of Barry. I first met Barry in 1954, when Watmore brought him to French Island, the first of my four prisons, and I was invited to join them for lunch. I was absolutely overawed by Barry's erudition, his vast knowledge, and his obvious intelligence, as well as his personal charm. He questioned me closely about the education program that I was running at French Island, which was unique at that time as it was based entirely on the voluntary participation of the prisoners. Even though in later years I got to know Barry quite well, I always held him in great respect and always addressed him as Sir John, never Jack. I realised much later that one of the reasons for this was the fact that he was very much older than me. When he was 50, I was just 21. In fact, he was 29 and a half years older than me, so it was quite reasonable at that time to treat him with great respect. The second time I met Barry was 3 years later in 1957 at the Langi Kalkal Training Centre for Young Offenders. This was my third prison after 1 year at French Island and 2 years at Beechworth. By this time, the Penal Reform Act of 1956 had been passed and the Victorian Parole Board had been established with Barry as its first chairman. During his visit to Langi Kalkal, all of the prisoners, some 60 or 70 of them, were assembled and Barry explained to them how the parole system could affect their lives. I believe that he made similar presentations in all of the other prisons around Victoria. I don't think I met Barry again until 1966, 9 years later. By this time, I'd left prisons and having completed an arts degree with a double major in psychology at this university, I was working as a lecturer in educational psychology at a nearby teacher's college. I was also studying part-time for a bachelor's degree in education and a postgraduate diploma of criminology. Our meeting came about because a lectureship in criminology at this university had been advertised. Even though I was totally underqualified for the position, certainly by today's standards, I submitted an application and was duly called for an interview. The interview panel was chaired by Sir John Barry, presumably in his role as the chairman of the Board of Studies in Criminology. And the other panel members mainly professors of law, professors of psychology and other related disciplines. It was quite a daunting panel of people to appear before. But Barry was extraordinarily kind to me and made me feel relatively at ease. Remarkably, and it was really quite remarkable when one thinks about it, I was given the job as a lecturer in criminology, would you believe? And even more remarkably, the position was tenured, or a permanent position. For the next 3 years, I came to know Barry reasonably well, particularly in his role as chairman of the Board of Studies, and later as the foundation president of the Australian and New Zealand Society of Criminology. At a personal level, he frequently sent me handwritten letters or notes on beautifully embossed cards, which are all gold and red and so on. Amazing. I lost most of them, unfortunately. Sometimes I received these notes two or three times a week, especially when he wanted to challenge something that I was reported to have said in the newspapers. Also, he often telephoned me, usually around 9:30 in the morning, and he would always start with a very breezy, "Barry here." His voice was very youthful, and occasionally I didn't immediately recognise who it was. I'm happy to say, however, that I never responded by saying, "Barry who?" that would have been the end of a nice relationship. In early June 1969, in one of his phone calls, Barry suggested that he and I should collaborate to write a book on parole in Australia, as by that time, all of the other Australian states had followed the lead of Victoria and established their own parole systems. I was extremely flattered at this suggestion, and just a little cheekily, about the only time I was ever cheeky with Barry, was to insist to him that on the basis of alphabetical precedence, he should be the senior author. I thought Barry and Biles sounded better than the other way around, and he agreed to that. Shortly after that, Barry called me to ask me to join him for dinner at University House a few days hence, as he was giving a lecture that evening elsewhere in the university. He made it quite clear that he was not inflicting his lecture on me. He just wanted my company for dinner. I will never forget that dinner. He was in fine form and seemed to be ready to talk about a wide range of subjects, particularly the occasional lecture he'd given on Australia's response to oil exploration. I asked him about his health, as I'd heard that he'd been unwell, but he assured me there was nothing to worry about and he was fine. I also asked him about what he would like me to do for our proposed book on parole, and he simply suggested that I, quote, "do some figuring," quote. After an excellent dinner and an excellent wine, he left to deliver his lecture. That was the last time I saw him. But perhaps 3 or 4 weeks later, maybe even been a little bit longer, I posted to him the results of my, quote, "figuring." It was quite a bundle of material, some 50 or 60 pages, I seem to recall. And I was a little surprised and disappointed, but he didn't let me have any reaction to this work that I'd done. Sometime later, however, his associate, Mr. Jimmy Edwards, rang to say that Sir John was unwell and that Edwards, on the orders of Sir John, had forwarded copies of my work to the other members of the parole board. He also told me that Sir John was in bed, able to sign a few checks, but obviously the situation did not look very promising at all. Sir John Barry died a few weeks later on 8 November 1969. Just under 2 weeks after Barry's death, the first biennial general meeting of the Australian New Zealand Society of Criminology was held, and after a moment's silence for Barry, Sir George Paton, then Chancellor of this university, was elected as the president of the society. Later in that meeting, Alec Watmore, the same Alec Watmore who was previously in charge of Hulks, urged the executive of the society, and I quote, "to consider the establishment of an annual oration or prize to honour the memory of the late Sir John Barry, end of quote. Thus, the idea for this oration, this lecture, was set in motion, and it has been held virtually every year since then. In preparing these brief remarks, I felt the need for more information on Barry's health at the time of our dinner in University House. To do this, I first started looking for my 1969 diary, and astoundingly, I found it. From that source, I established that our dinner was on Tuesday, 17 June of that year, just under 5 months before his death. To pursue this matter further, I reread the final chapter in Mark Finnane's biography of Barry, and from that source, I concluded that at the time of our dinner, Barry was obviously aware of his health problems, but was not specifically aware that his condition was terminal. Looking back over more than 40 years since his death, my overwhelming reaction is that it was a terrible tragedy that he died so young. He was only 66, and as is John Barry, approaching 78, that seems remarkably young to die. The tragedy was worst, of course, for his family and for his many close friends. But it was also a tragedy for many others, including the scholarly and legal worlds in which he played such an active part. And in scholarly, I mean criminology as well as history. He was well known for his work in that field as well. Barry, it can be no doubt, was committed to making the world a better place, and potentially he had so much more to offer. Another person has clearly shown he is deeply committed to making the world a better place is our speaker tonight, Peter Norden. I've known Peter for many years and I've always admired him for the challenging jobs that he's taken on. In one capacity or another, Peter has been involved with the Australian criminal justice system for, he says, more than 40 years, beginning as an honorary probation officer during his social work studies at this university. In 1977, as a young graduate, he was the founder and the inspiration for the Brosnan Centre, which assists and advocates for young prisoners on their release from custody. In 1985, when Father John Brosnan, also an old friend of mine, retired from Pentridge Prison, Peter was appointed as his successor, where he remained for 7 years as both chaplain and an advocate for prison reform. Over the last 20 years, Peter has continued his involvement in the fields of social policy and research, as well as public advocacy on behalf of the disadvantaged in our community. He has extensive background and experience to speak on the topic of his lecture, which is Ned Kelly, John Barry, and the role of social activism in criminal justice reform. Peter, I formally invite you to present the John Barry Memorial Lecture for 2010. Would you, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Peter.
University colleagues, members of the judiciary, past and present, members of the Barry family, ladies and gentlemen. I'm a little overwhelmed at the extent of the interest in this topic throughout Australia that I've realised over the last few days. This evening, I want to take you on a journey. It's a journey that recalls some aspects of the life of Ned Kelly, the contribution made by John Barry, and some key experiences from my own experience in the criminal justice system. It's a journey into the past so that we can imagine a different future, particularly with respect to criminal justice policy. I acknowledge the traditional owners of this land. Our journey this evening has as much significance for our Indigenous brothers and sisters as for any other group in Australian society today. On this day, the 11th of November, 1880, Ned Kelly was hanged from the gallows of the old Melbourne jail. 5,000 stood outside in protest. Rather sizable crowd, given the population of Melbourne in 1880 was 280,000. Close to 50,000 signatures were attached to the petition of mercy that was submitted to the Executive Council. The Herald that afternoon reported on the event in these words: "The general sympathy which appeared to be felt for the condemned man was not confined to the lower orders alone, as the crowd which assembled around the jail gates this morning testified. Women, many of them young, well-dressed and apparently respectable, were there mixing with the others. The Telegraph reporter, on the other hand, described the crowd as a mob of nondescript idlers whose morbid and depraved tastes had led them from the pursuit of honest toil. It must be acknowledged that the criminal and the most depraved classes in the community predominated." These two contrasting accounts from the Herald and the Telegraph reporters at the time are evidence that even 130 years ago, there were strong and different perspectives about, in our community, about crime, its sources, and how our government should respond to it. Kelly's last request to the prison governor, in a letter that he wrote just a few days before his execution, asked, "If you would grant permission for my friends to have my body, that they might bury it in consecrated ground." Kelly biographer Ian Jones reported that the headless, mutilated corpse was put in a rough red gum coffin, covered with quicklime, and buried in the jail yard the following day without any marking on the wall behind it. He noted that one newspaper gloated, "The body of the last Victorian bushranger was laid to rot in unconsecrated ground." Ronald Ryan was the last man hanged in Australia in 1967. I note that one of his defence barristers is here this evening, Brian Burke. On the 20th anniversary of his execution, I obtained permission from the Pentridge governor for his three daughters, by then adult women, to lay a floral wreath over his unmarked gravesite. Within a minute of our departure from the gravesite, as we turned the corner by one of the blue stone walls, that floral wreath was thrown in a rubbish dump master on the orders of the same prison governor. 40 years after his execution, I persuaded Ryan's three daughters to seek an exhumation of their father's remains from the former prison site at Coburg. The gravesite remained neglected and unrecognised, as it still does today. And this was despite the public commitment made by the Kennett government the day after the prison was decommissioned in 1997 to establish a memorial plaque acknowledging the remains of those, including Ned Kelly, who'd been executed and or buried on that site. The license of exhumation was granted by the Bracks government, and finally Ryan's daughters took possession of their father's remains and he was given a Christian burial. 130 years after his execution, Ned Kelly should be extended the same privilege. Over the past 40 years of my close association with persons convicted of criminal offences, and in my observation of the criminal sanctions imposed on them by the Australian courts, it's intrigued me how the general community seems to be so divided as to how best to deal with behaviour that breaches the criminal law. Only 13 years before Ned Kelly was executed by the state of Victoria, the transportation of English and Irish convicts to Australia ceased. What happened in those post-Gold Rush years are no longer within living memory, but they remain within the shared discourse of members of our community still alive today. What do I mean by shared discourse? Well, it's the stories passed down from generation to generation that impact on our thinking and the shaping of public policy today. Reflecting more deeply on my experiences working within the Australian criminal justice system from an early age, I can't help but think that our mentality, our mindset, our policy frameworks as a nation are still shaped by this heritage of our penal settlement past. It's interesting to reflect on how key aspects and experiences in our lives help to shape our convictions and our lifelong concerns. John Barry, in whose memory this annual criminology lecture is held, was a very young man when, soon after he graduated in law from the University of Melbourne, was attached to work in the law offices of Luke Murphy. There he earned £1 a week, and he walked to Murphy's Queen Street offices from his boarding house room at 47 Drummond Street in Carlton. The work at Luke Murphy's law offices exposed him for the first time to a prison, the institution whose role and function would preoccupy him intellectually for most of the rest of his life. "I've spent some time in jail since I last wrote to you," he teased his mother, Nettie, in July 1921, having just turned 18. "I'm not too much in love with prison life as I saw it either," he added. During these years, young John Barry also developed his distaste for capital punishment. He observed closely the 1922 trial and subsequent conviction of Colin Campbell Ross for the murder of a 12-year-old girl. Based purely on circumstantial evidence, Ross went to the gallows despite the view of one of the High Court appeal judges, Isaac Isaacs, who felt that there was, quote, a danger of miscarriage of justice in the proceedings. Jack Barry thought it was, quote, a crying shame. Ross was finally pardoned by the Victorian government 86 years later in May 2008. Barry was also involved in March 1924 in the Victorian Court of Criminal Appeal in the case of Angus Murray, who'd been convicted of the murder of bank manager Thomas Berryman in Glenferrie. Murray was an associate of Squizzy Taylor in the Melbourne underworld at the time. Young John Barry, then aged 20, I estimate, prepared the brief for the defence barrister, Eugene Gorman. The accused was eventually hanged in April 1924. Barry was deeply affected by his associations with Murray. In responding to his parents' concerns about over-involvement at the time, he wrote, "You and Dad seem to fear me getting a moral squint on things as a result of my forced associations. Our work teaches us introspection that prevents all self-deception. We view man's evilness detachedly, calmly, impersonally." As a result of his involvement in this appeal trial, Barry became and remained a vigorous opponent of capital punishment. It's clear that young John Barry, exposed to the harshness of prison life and the scandal of capital punishment, was deeply affected by these experiences. And it seems evident that these experiences played no insignificant role in his ongoing commitment to justice and fair treatment and the defence of human rights. So the invitation to present this John Barry Memorial Lecture on the 130th anniversary of the execution of Ned Kelly encouraged me to share something of my own journey and some of the lessons learnt from my own exposure to the Australian criminal justice system from a very young age. Like John Barry, I was confronted as a young man with the harsh reality and complex challenges which criminal behaviour presents to our society. From an early age, I recognised the apparent, dare I say, obvious failure of our criminal justice systems across the country in responding to crime, the hesitancy of our Australian community in finding alternative crime prevention measures, and the persistence shown by our ongoing overuse of a prison system that's an expensive failure and wasteful of human and financial resources. So it's for this reason that I've set the focus of my address this evening on the role of social activism in criminal justice reform. In different ways, both Ned Kelly and John Barry were activists in relation to the criminal justice system. Kelly was a rebel and a convicted criminal. Irish Australians saw him as a martyr in the fight against English misrule. His jailery letter spoke clearly of a vision of a republican rebellion. His heritage is a complex one, reflected in the very first journalistic reports of his execution and the divergent descriptions of his supporters quoted in the media reports of the day. His heritage is more complex than that of some colonial hero, but he did act vigorously, violently, against what he identified as discriminatory and corrupt police practice. How would any of us today respond to the repeated sexual assault of female members of our family by members of the Victorian Police Force? What steps would you take if you felt there was an orchestrated plan not to arrest you on outstanding charges, but to ensure that you weren't taken alive? The most reliable historical research that's been completed in recent years on Kelly, by the likes of historian Ian Jones, has established the credibility of such interpretations. Kelly wasn't prepared to passively become a victim of an unjust system, but to actively confront it with dire consequences for himself and, of course, of the three police officers that he killed. John Barry, on the other hand, was a well-respected judge of the Supreme Court of Victoria. But he too was an activist. He was a foundation vice president of the Australian Council for Civil Liberties in 1935 and foundational secretary of the Medico-Legal Society of Victoria and its president from 1948 to 49. He was appointed a Supreme Court judge in 1947, and as Mr. Justice Teague reported in the Australian Dictionary of Biography, he was seen as the one progressive element on an extremely conservative bench at the time. His public activism as a member of the Australian Labor Party was less pronounced after his judicial appointment, as you'd expect. But his activism continued in other areas, being the foundational chairman of the Board of Studies in the Department of Criminology at the University of Melbourne from 1951, and of course of the Victorian Parole Board from 1957. How would he view the current threat to the operation of the parole system by the imposition of post-sentence detention on those convicted of serious sexual offences? Citizens detained indeterminately by the state after the completion of their sentence imposed by the courts. In the Australian and British Criminal Code, one is only to be punished once for a crime for which one's been convicted. It's my belief that governments that pass such legislation permitting post-sentence detention are expressing a clear lack of confidence in the judicial system and the proper role of the parole system of community monitoring and community supervision. They're also displaying a less than courageous response to certain popular media outlets that seek to make themselves the shaper of criminal justice policy. You do need courage to oppose such reactionary elements in our society. As a political representative, you need courage to lead the community in the areas of criminal justice reform, especially in the period leading to a state election as we have in Victoria at the present time. A courageous American, Frederick Douglass, who was advocating against the use of slavery more than 150 years ago, said at the time, "Those who profess to favour freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without ploughing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and never will." So I wish to present two scenarios from my prior engagement with the Australian criminal justice system that are representative of the many experiences that I've had that convinced me of the need for a systemic change in our nation's approach to breaches of the criminal law. I've undertaken much of this analysis according to what's been identified as heuristic research, a research process designed for the exploration and interpretation of experience, which uses the self of the researcher. Such reflection is something which can contribute to social policy analysis and formulation. It's indeed a fitting opportunity for sharing in this John Barry Memorial Lecture. The first scenario I wish to present this evening relates to police use of deadly force. Police shootings in Victoria, You Deserve to Know the Truth. This was the title of a book written by the families of Mark Militano, Graham Jensen and Jed Horton, with the support of legal staff from the Flemington Kensington Community Legal Centre. In total, 11 men had been shot dead by Victorian police officers over the previous 2 years. Militano, Jensen and Horton were three of the young men who'd been killed by police, the first two in relation to suspected armed robberies that occurred in Melbourne in the mid-1980s, and Horton as part of the investigation following the tragic killing of two young police constables, Tyne and Anair, in Wall Street, Prahran, in October 1988. In the foreword to that publication, I wrote, "The suspicion that revenge has been allowed to overcome reason following the tragic Wall Street killings must be answered. The number of deaths as a result of police shootings continued to rise over the following years. Between January and May 1994, there were 7 deaths as a result of the use of firearms by members of the Victorian Police Force. How could this be explained, given that in New South Wales, with a similar population, a generally similar pattern of criminal behaviour, there'd only been a fraction of this number of deaths resulting from police shootings over the same period of time? My explanation at the time was that the deaths followed from some particularly difficult circumstances in Victoria in the preceding years. In March 1986, a bomb was exploded outside the then police headquarters in Russell Street. Tragically, a young police officer, policewoman, was killed. Many others were injured. Many more lives could have been lost. And it was only 2 years later that the lives of the two young constables were tragically taken in the Wall Street murders. It's my belief that these two major incidents helped to change the culture within the Victorian Police Force at the time. During the late 1980s and early 1990s, whenever an operational member of the police was confronted by a citizen threatening them with any sort of weapon, be it a gun, a knife, baseball bat, or whatever, it was the formal practice to extend a warning to the person to drop the weapon. If the person failed to drop the weapon and continued to present a potential threat to the officer, it was standard practice in Victoria to shoot several times to the central body of the person posing the threat in order to remove that threat. This training practice had been implemented officially by the Police Training Academy. This protocol resulted in the large number of persons killed as a result of police use of deadly force. On one occasion, Victoria Police had a tip-off that an armed robbery was about to take place. Instead of placing a young or a uniformed officer outside the bank or the TAB, an unmarked van was placed directly outside with Special Operation Group members heavily armed inside. As the offenders, Paul Skews and Stephen Crome, came out of the front door of the bank after the robbery, they were confronted by heavily armed police and were both killed in May 1994. Jude McCulloch from Monash University analysed the tactics the Victoria Police resorted to during this period. She argued that the establishment of specialist counter-terrorist units within state police forces in the mid-1970s led to an increasingly militarised form of policing. Although set up to counter terrorism, McCulloch found that they'd been used in a wide and increasing range of traditional police operations. Over the years, the general public, of course, had little sympathy with the interests of people committing serious crimes like armed robbery. But in the early 1990s, a growing number of citizens shot dead by Victoria Police were those without a criminal record at all. They were distinguished by those suffering from serious mental illness. The critical death that helped to change this deadly policy in Victoria was that of Colleen Richmond, who was shot at Hanover Welfare Services in St Kilda in September 1994. Up until that untimely death, Victorian Police Minister Pat McNamara defended the police's right to use firearms to protect themselves in this manner. I conducted the memorial service for Colleen Richmond at Sacred Heart Church in Grey Street, St Kilda. Following the service, more than 200 people joined a march down Fitzroy Street to a protest rally at Katani Gardens on the St Kilda foreshore. As I joined the marches down Fitzroy Street, I received a phone call from the Police Minister and Deputy Premier, Pat McNamara. The Minister informed me that the government had taken the decision that day to retrain the police in the use of firearms through what was to become known as Project Beacon. It had taken several years and too many deaths, but finally the battle was won and the advocacy work on behalf of Victorian citizens was finally successful. The policies were to be changed. It had finally been established that the number one priority of Victoria Police members should be the protection of human life. Following Project Beacon, the death toll resulting from police shootings in Victoria dropped dramatically to less than one a year and remained that way for more than 10 years. But the whole country was shocked when, in early December 2008, a 15-year-old boy, Tyler Cassidy, was shot dead by four Victorian police officers outside Northland Shopping Centre. He was emotionally disturbed and armed himself with two knives stolen minutes before from a local supermarket. The senior Victorian police representatives immediately reported at the time that the officers had no other option than to fire 10 bullets at this disturbed young man. The present coronial inquiry will determine the answer to that assertion. Most reasonable Australians knew intuitively that there had to be a better way. The present Chief Commissioner of Police, Simon Overland, has since directed a serious review of police strategies in relation to such matters. The emphasis must remain, he said, on securing the situation and protecting human life. This was the insight of Project Beacon 15 years before. My recent reflections seek to answer the question as to how the Victorian community allowed these deaths over the years to occur. The lack of public scrutiny and accountability seemed to be the explanation. So the second scenario I want to explore this evening is in relation to high security supermax prisons. For many, many years, H Division was the section of Pentridge Prison with the harshest discipline. It was the punishment and isolation block for those who'd escaped and those who'd seriously breached prison regulations. Each Wednesday morning, I'd visit this unit. H Division was a world within a world. and the staff were the hard men of the prison service. Whenever a new prisoner arrived, he was confronted with what was known as the reception biff. Surrounded by several officers, he was stripped naked and then subjected to a series of physical blows until he fell to the ground. The division was reserved for any prisoner who'd breached prison regulations. But his first experience upon arrival was to be himself the victim of a serious assault by those whose task it was to uphold the law. This practice continued right until the Pentridge prison closure in 1997. The reality of this brutalising effect of this systematic bashing by prison guards was accurately portrayed in the play Every Night, Every Night by Ray Mooney, which was published in 1985. That play shows how a young offender in the person of Christopher Dale Flannery was the subject of such treatment. Flannery would in later years take revenge in his violent behaviour towards others, which earned him the title Mr. Rent-a-Kill. Father Brosnan, my predecessor as chaplain at Pentridge, used to say that the systematic brutality in H Division had turned bike thieves into murderers. There was a lot of evidence in later years to confirm that point of view. But as Mooney's play depicted, there was never an independent witness present to observe these proceedings, only the closed group of H Division officers and individual inmates. Every Wednesday morning, I observed the battered faces of those newly welcomed into H Division. The official account was that they'd fallen over or had attempted to assault an officer. In July 1980, a new maximum security division was opened within the Pentridge grounds called Jika Jika. Jika Jika maximum security section cost $7 million, a lot of money at the time, to construct, and was of a modern design, mostly concrete and razor ribbon wire, with a lot of electronic gadgetry. The prison made extensive use of electronic surveillance, and all doors were remotely controlled using compressed air. The unit was actually awarded the Excellence in Concrete Award by the Concrete Institute of Australia in 1979. But it didn't take long for the prisoners and the staff of JICA to recognise the shortcomings of both the regime and the physical environment, and to become aware of its impact on human behaviour and the health of those living and working there. As those who lived there were quick to point out, H Division was run by physical brutality. Like its equivalent in New South Wales, Katingle, Jika Jika played with people's minds. The biggest problem with the operation of Jika Jika was the Prison Classification Committee. Those who were assigned as inmates to Jika were always told by the Classification Committee that if they cooperated, kept the rules and regulations, and do what was asked of them, they'd be eventually returned to mainstream maximum security prison life outside of Jika Jika. One group of five prisoners had been given these instructions on more than one occasion. Years passed with no change in their classification. They felt they were being buried in Jika with absolutely no sign that there'd ever be a change. As prison chaplain, I'd written to the prison's minister, the late Jim Kennan, asking for one of this group of five, Robert Wright, to be moved from Jika Jika to B Division, another high security area. Wright had been in Jika Jika for more than 6 years, since soon after it was opened. I wrote to Jim Kennan, "I believe it's unjust to hold Wright any longer in Jika. Other prisoners have committed equally as serious crimes. No other prisoner's been held in that division as long as Robert Wright has. I've made personal representations to you previously about the brutalising effect of long-term placement in Jika. But I was given no indication when, if ever, Wright would be moved." In October 1987, Wright and four other prisoners barricaded themselves in their six-man unit and set fire to newspapers and other materials they'd stored over some weeks. The prison officers failed to break their way into the strongly barricaded unit, and the five men died of smoke asphyxiation within less than 30 minutes. Monash University's Bree Carlton recently completed a comprehensive and critical analysis of the Jika Jika tragedy. She explained that her book was written, quote, motivated by a desire to resurrect and reconstruct the Jika experience in order to recognise past injustices and circumvent the continuing proliferation of harm and violence-producing prison regimes in the present. Following the fire, for the next 48 hours, television news and current affairs couldn't get enough of the story. My repeated message was that it was a tragedy that could have been prevented. The government had been warned. The regime that had operated in the Jika Jika section could never have been sustained. The government inaction in relation to such representations was reprehensible. As a result of the public alarm about the deaths and the saturation media coverage, the prison minister announced within a few days that Jika Jika would be closed. The inmates moved to other sections of Pentridge Prison and other Victorian prisons. In doing so, he himself criticised the regime there and referred to it as an electronic zoo. It was a shame he failed to act earlier. The Chief Coroner, Hal Hellenstein, reported on the investigation into the deaths and the fire in Jika Jika 2 years later, in 1989. In his conclusions to that coronial inquiry, he stated, I find that the Office of Corrections, by its employees, servants and agents, has contributed to the cause of death of Wright, Loughnan, Gallagher, McGawley and Morris. The conduct of the Office of Corrections in this case raises deep and fundamental concern for our community's free institutions and its democratic style. In this inquest, the Office of Corrections has sought to be unaccountable. It's recommended that there be an independent and general public inquiry into the Office of Corrections and its administration of the prison service in Victoria. The subsequent inquiry was undertaken by a retired Supreme Court judge, Justice Murray, who tabled his report in State Parliament in March 1990. It's my view that the Murray report failed to substantially deal with the serious issues that the coroner had raised. The political heat had gone from the issue, and the Murray inquiry in the end was seen as burying the issue once and for all. When the Jika Jika security unit was opened in 1980, the Correctional Services brochure announced that, quote, it's been designed to meet community expectations of the secure detention of dangerous offenders and the provision of humane containment for such persons. But events clearly underscore the conclusion that it was an expensive failure. You can't use terms like humane containment, and in your policies and procedures, fail to recognise the importance of treating people, even high security prisoners, as real people. The famous criminologist Stanley Cohen, more than 20 years ago, explained that, quote, what the social control system does is invariably accompanied by much talk. These good stories stand for or signify what the system likes to think it's doing, justify or rationalise what it's already done, and indicate what it would like to be doing if only given the chance and the resources. This talk, Cohen said, also has other functions: to maintain and increase the self-confidence, worth and interests of those who work in the system, to protect them from criticism, and to suggest that they're doing all right in a difficult world. Cohen suggested that the new words used, like corrections, might bear only the most oblique relationship to what's actually happening in the cells, the buildings, the corridors, the offices, and the encounters of the social control apparatus. In other words, the prisons and so-called correctional programs. More recently, David Garland, Professor of Law and Sociology at New York University, developed the same theme when he explained that the current rules of political engagement ensure that governments and legislatures are highly attuned to public concerns, particularly to the sentiment that offenders are being insufficiently punished or dangerous individuals inadequately controlled. And he said, there is a great pressure to enact measures that express and relieve these concerns. Garland further explained that the chief aims of the criminal justice system are not at all about correction, but, quote, to assuage popular outrage, reassure the public, and restore the credibility of the system, all of which are political rather than penological concerns. Thinking this through, one's led to ask serious questions about the real purposes of such ineffective criminological policies and practices that have been described. The last 10 years has led me to a further level of action in response to such critical incidents and experiences within the criminal justice system. How to convince the Australian community to bring the same critical analysis to poor performance and outcomes, which as a community we bring to the areas of health, education, housing, transport, and welfare. So in this concluding section, I want to make some observations about the present political climate and to present some solutions, or at least some alternative strategies that could be more effective in preventing crime and in helping to maintain a cohesive Australian society. Governments around Australia face a critical challenge in seeking to shape a more effective criminal justice policy. And it's particularly relevant this month in the state of Victoria as we approach a state election. Since March of this year, it became clear that the state opposition wanted to make law and order concerns central to their election strategy. This has involved commitments to substantially increase police numbers and the placement of security guards on trains and railway stations. The Victorian opposition also promised to completely ban suspended sentences, and in doing so, in practice, has committed a future government to the construction of a major new prison to deal with the increased prison population. The Brumby government has responded largely by attempting to match the opposition's promises. Such measures represent an incredible increase in expenditure to law and order and confirmed many of the worst fears of those in the community sector who know how ineffective such measures would be. A good example of an alternative approach is presented in the Smart Justice Campaign, made up of a wide consortium of criminal justice reform organisations, including VCOS and the Federation of Community Legal Centres. The Smart Justice Campaign seeks to hold both major Victorian political parties more accountable to the electorate by focusing on a factual analysis of the criminal justice system and the misuse of criminal sanctions and the overuse of imprisonment. Similar work's been done in recent years in New South Wales by Justice Action. More than 30 years' experience in monitoring criminal justice policies told me that there's little to be gained from a bidding war on who could be tougher on law and order other than pure political advantage. Good social policy can never evolve in this way. The essential goal in this process is to find a way to hold power, or if in opposition, a way to obtain political power. Meanwhile, the present New South Wales government struggles to meet the costs of a state prison population about to reach the 10,000 mark. At the current rate of increase of the state's prison population, New South Wales needs to construct a new prison every year. For more than five decades now, New South Wales has had an imprisonment rate approximately double that of Victoria, but their crime rate has not significantly changed, and it remains largely comparable to that of Victoria. A recent Australian Bureau of Statistics report indicated that from 1994 to 2007, Australia's prison population had increased at an annual rate of 3.7%, while the number of prisoners with prior imprisonment increased at 3.2% per year on average. These are rates much higher than the national population increase, measured at about 1.3% per year on average during the same period. Clearly, The construction and operation of the new prisons required to house such a dramatic increase in prison numbers takes limited financial resources from such critical areas as health, education, housing, and transport. Do we as a nation seriously believe that the increased incarceration of young adult males from the most disadvantaged communities in Australia will result in anything more than a hardened criminal subculture in these neighbourhoods? So after more than 30 years of being confronted by a system that seems to excel in wasting both human and limited financial resources, I felt a strong need to take a different approach. And it was this determination that led me to join with efforts with Professor Tony Vincent, now of the University of Sydney, formerly a commissioner of the New South Wales Department of Corrections from the late 1970s. We set out to confirm some of our professional observations in a quantitative, measurable form. Over the last 10 years, I project managed the research which Professor Vincent undertook, mapping the concentration of disadvantage by postcode for every part of Australia. More than 20 measures of disadvantage were used, including court, conviction, and imprisonment, in addition to the regular measurements used by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, such as income, education, employment, and housing. Professor Vincent's identified and established a clear pattern of correlation in this quantitative research between high levels of disadvantage and criminal conviction and imprisonment. What the researchers establishes is nothing new, of course, but the extent and the detail of the measurements that Vincent completed is confronting. How to make the implications more confronting to the Australian community, it's hard to know. 10 years ago, I attended a conference in Chicago where a paper was presented outlining the strategy being used in the state of Louisiana that used the demographic reading scores of 10 to 12-year-olds to predict how many prisons needed to be constructed in 10 years' time. You might laugh, but Vincent's research indicates that we're doing precisely the same thing here in Australia. We know the strong positive correlations that exist between such variables as low preschool attendance, early school leaving, lack of further education and skills training, and eventual unemployment, with the frequency of criminal convictions and eventual imprisonment later in life. Yet we persist with attempts to manage such problems by extending the interventions of the criminal justice system rather than addressing the problem at its source. The result, Vincent reported, is that the most disadvantaged communities around Australia, both in metropolitan, rural, and remote areas, are being more and more deeply mined by the instrumentalities of the criminal justice system. Of course, we see the impact of this most clearly when we refer to the overrepresentation of the Australian Indigenous community within the states and territories' prison populations. But the problem is not limited to our Indigenous brothers and sisters. It's the same pattern for every severely disadvantaged community in Australia. How to address such entrenched long-term disadvantage does not rest with the criminal justice system. It's the criminal justice system that's left to pick up the casualties when our other social systems have failed us. Instead, what is necessary to produce lasting change are carefully planned, collaborative, long-term, multidisciplinary interventions in the most disadvantaged communities that seek to bring about real participation and empowerment. Within Australia, similar analyses and recommendations have been made for many years. So politicians, especially those who seek the power of government by promising more and more resources to the criminal justice system, while knowing that real solutions rest elsewhere, ought to know better. They do know better, but they're prepared to compromise their beliefs in the hope of obtaining or preserving the right to govern. California, once the wealthiest state in the United States, is threatened with bankruptcy, while spending more on the construction and operation of its prison system than it does on higher education. $8 billion on corrections, 10% of its state budget. Do we really want to head in the same direction? Are there no political leaders across our country of the courage of their convictions to take on the outspoken media commentators who seek themselves to shape criminal justice policy instead of the elected government? So in concluding these reflections and this call for a more rational, evidence-based policy direction for the future of the Australian criminal justice system today, I believe that it's critical that we acknowledge the limitations of our present systems and our need for a substantial change of direction. Similar calls have been made in recent times by US Senator Jim Webb in the United States, a country that's got 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prison population. The Open Society Institute in Washington, D.C. has also called for multidisciplinary collaboration in responding to the underlying equity and justice issues that fuel the cycle of incarceration. In Australia, courageous political leadership will certainly be required if we're to move forward in the coming decades rather than reinforce the failures of the past. Even on the anniversary of his execution, I'm not sure that Ned Kelly's heritage could assist us with this challenge, but I am sure that the qualities displayed by John Barry through his lifetime of community service could well assist. I remain convinced that social change comes from a small number of committed individuals who have the determination and the courage to make things better in our world. Finally, I look to the future generation of lawyers, academics, social activists, and community organisers to consider this challenge, one that should never be left in the hands of our political representatives.
Can I join Professor David Bowles in welcoming you to this lecture and in acknowledging the traditional owners of the land in which we meet. As David said so eloquently, the University is very proud to host an important public event in the memory of John Barry, and we're grateful to everyone who's helped make tonight possible. Like David, I'd like to acknowledge the many members of the Barry family who are with us in strength tonight and who by their presence show such continuing support for this lecture series. John and Arda Barry, Matthew Barry, Susan Barry, Don Wales, Rosemary and Mark Whitman, and Robin and John Reed, welcome all. You are very welcome indeed. Peter suggested in this lecture that John Barry remains a major figure in the discipline of criminology, an important figure for numerous other reasons, for his work on civil liberties, his opposition to the death penalty, his contribution to journalistic ethics, and his extraordinary contributions as a writer and a biographer. This is a fine legacy and one that we're proud to see preserved through this lecture, which speaks to contemporary society in so many important ways. So on behalf of the university, and in particular its School of Social and Political Sciences, my thanks to the Barry family for your support making this lecture possible, and to our guest lecturer, Peter Norden. It was a delight to welcome Peter to the university, welcome back Peter to the university 2 years ago as a Vice Chancellor's Fellow, which is this wonderful institution of many years standing here that allows the university to support the fine work of a range of individuals in the community, invite them to be part of the university community, but ask nothing of them except that they do what they do so well. Some people, of course, succeed in being activists and some succeed in being scholars. Peter is a rare person who brings those two things together so well. He has been, of course, a courageous advocate, but a calm advocate, a calm voice, unafraid of speaking in and to the media directly about very difficult matters of crime and punishment, as we've heard tonight, about prisoners' rights, so rarely discussed, about social disadvantage. As a social services advocate, he's forged links with scholars and experts to bring their insights into the practical world of prisoner support and prisoner rehabilitation. He's worthy of the accolades that have been thrown his way. This is someone who's given his life to this cause. We are proud that he's a member of this university community, and on behalf of all of us tonight, I'd like to thank for presenting a lecture on Ned Kelly, John Barry, and the vital role of social activism and criminal justice reform. Please join me in thanking you.